This is Audible.
Cadman presents Go Set a Watchman, a novel by Harper Lee. Performed by Reese Witherspoon. In memory of Mr. Lee and Alice. Part 1. 1. Since Atlanta, she had looked out the dining car window with a delight almost physical. Over her breakfast coffee, she watched the last of Georgia's hills recede and the red earth appear. And with it, 10 roofed houses set in the middle of swept yards. And in the yards, the inevitable verbena grew, surrounded by whitewashed tires. She grinned when she saw her first TV antenna atop an unpainted Negro house. As they multiplied, her joy rose. Jean Louise Finch always made this journey by air, but she decided to go by train from New York to Macomb Junction on her 5th annual trip home. For one thing, she had the life scared out of her the last time she was on a plane. The pilot elected to fly through a tornado. For another thing, flying home meant her father rising at 3 a.m, driving 100 miles to meet her in Mobile, and doing a full day's work afterwards. He was 72 now, and this was no longer fair. She was glad she had decided to go by train. Trains had changed since her childhood, and the novelty of the experience amused her. A fat genie of a porter materialized when she pressed a button on a wall. At her bidding, a stainless steel wash basin popped out of another wall, and there was a john one could prop one's feet on. She resolved not to be intimidated by several messages stenciled around her compartment. A roomette, they called it. But when she went to bed the night before, she succeeded in folding herself up into the wall because she had ignored an injunction to pull this lever down over brackets. A situation remedied by the porter, to her embarrassment, as her habit was to sleep only in pajama tops. Luckily, he happened to be patrolling the corridor when the trap snapped shut with her in it.
"I'll get you out, miss,"
he called in answer to her poundings from within.
"No, please," she said. "Just tell me how to get out." "I can do it with my back turned," he said, and did.
When she awoke that morning, the train was switching and chugging in the Atlanta yards. But in obedience to another sign in her compartment, she stayed in bed until College Park flashed by. When she dressed, she put on her Macomb clothes. Gray slacks, a black sleeveless blouse, white socks, and loafers. Although it was 4 hours away, she could hear her aunt's sniff of disapproval. When she was starting on her 4th cup of coffee, the Crescent Limited honked like a giant goose at its northbound mate and rumbled across the Chattahoochee into Alabama. The Chattahoochee is wide, flat, and muddy. It was low today. A yellow sandbar had reduced its flow to a trickle. Perhaps it sings in the wintertime, she thought. I do not remember a line of that poem. Piping down the valleys wild? No. Did he write to a waterfowl? Or was it a waterfall? She sternly repressed a tendency to boisterousness when she reflected that Sidney Lanier must have been somewhat like her long-departed cousin, Joshua Singleton St. Clair, whose private literary preserves stretched from the Black Belt to Bayou La Batre. Jean Louise's aunt often held up Cousin Joshua to her as a family example not lightly to be discountenanced. He was a splendid figure of a man. He was a poet. He was cut off in his prime. And Jean Louise would do well to remember that he was a credit to the family. His pictures did the family well. Cousin Joshua looked like a ratty Algernon Swinburne. Jean Louise smiled to herself when she remembered her father telling her the rest of it. Cousin Joshua was cut off, all right, not by the hand of God, but by Caesar's hopes. When at the university, Cousin Joshua studied too hard and thought too much. In fact, he read himself straight out of the 19th century. He affected an Inverness cape and wore jackboots he had a blacksmith make up from his own design. Cousin Joshua was frustrated by the authorities when he fired upon the president of the university, who in his opinion was little more than a sewage disposal expert. This was no doubt true, but an idle excuse for assault with a deadly weapon. After much passing around of money, Cousin Joshua was moved across the tracks and placed in state accommodations for the irresponsible, where he remained for the rest of his days. They said he was reasonable in every respect until someone mentioned that president's name. Then his face would become distorted. He would assume a whooping crane attitude and hold it for 8 hours or more, and nothing or nobody could make him lower his leg until he forgot about that man. On clear days, Cousin Joshua read Greek, and he left a thin volume of verse printed privately by a firm in Tuscaloosa. The poetry was so ahead of its time, no one has deciphered it yet. But Jean Louise's aunt keeps it displayed casually, and prominently, on a table in the living room. Jean Louise laughed aloud, then looked around to see if anyone had heard her. Her father had a way of undermining his sister's lectures on the innate superiority of any given Finch. He always told his daughter the rest of it, quietly and solemnly, but Jean Louise sometimes thought she detected an unmistakably profane glint in Atticus Finch's eyes. Or was it merely the light hitting his glasses? She never knew. The countryside and the train had subsided to a gentle roll, and she could see nothing but pasture land and black cows from window to horizon. She wondered why she had never thought her country beautiful. The station at Montgomery nestled in an elbow of the Alabama, and when she got off the train to stretch her legs, the returning familiar with its drabness, lights, and curious odors rose to meet her. "There's something missing," she thought. "Hot boxes, that's it." A man goes along under the train with a crowbar. There is a clank, and then tss, tss, tss. White smoke comes up, and you think you're inside a chafing dish. These things run on oil now. For no reason, an ancient fear gnawed her. She had not been in this station for 20 years, but when she was a child and went to the capital with Atticus, she was terrified lest the swaying train plunge down the riverbank and drown them all. But when she boarded again for home, she forgot. The train clacketed through pine forests and honked derisively at a gaily painted bell-funneled museum piece sidetracked in a clearing. It bore the sign of a lumber concern, and the Crescent Limited could have swallowed it whole with room to spare. Greenville, Evergreen, Macomb Junction. She had told the conductor not to forget to let her off, and because the conductor was an elderly man, she anticipated his joke. He would rush at Macomb Junction like a bat out of hell and stop the train a quarter of a mile past the little station. Then when he bade her goodbye, he would say he was sorry. He almost forgot. Trains changed. Conductors never did. Being funny at flag stops with young ladies was a mark of the profession. And Atticus, who could predict the actions of every conductor from New Orleans to Cincinnati, would be waiting accordingly, not 6 steps away from her point of debarkation. Home was Macomb County, a gerrymander some 70 miles long and spreading 30 miles at its widest point, a wilderness dotted with tiny settlements, the largest of which was Macomb, the county seat. Until comparatively recently in its history, Macomb County was so cut off from the rest of the nation that some of its citizens, unaware of the South's political predilections over the past 90 years, still voted Republican. No trains went there. Macon Junction, a courtesy title, was located in Abbott County, 20 miles away. Bus service was erratic and seemed to go nowhere, but the federal government had forced a highway or two through the swamps, thus giving the citizens an opportunity for free egress. But few people took advantage of the roads, and why should they? If you did not want much, there was plenty. The county and the town were named for a Colonel Mason Macon, a man whose misplaced self-confidence and overweening willfulness brought confusion and confoundment to all who rode with him in the Creek Indian Wars. The territory in which he operated was vaguely hilly in the north and flat in the south, on the fringes of the coastal plain. Colonel Macon, convinced that Indians hated to fight on flat land, scoured the northern reaches of the territory, looking for them. When his general discovered that Macon was meandering in the hills, while the Creeks were lurking in every pine thicket in the south, he dispatched a friendly Indian runner to Macon with the message, "Move south, damn you." Macon was convinced this was a Creek plot to trap him. Was there not a blue-eyed, red-headed devil leading them? He made the friendly Indian runner his prisoner, and he moved farther north until his forces became hopelessly lost in the forest primeval, where they sat out the wars in considerable bewilderment. After enough years had passed to convince Colonel Macon that the message might have been genuine after all, he began a purposeful march to the south, and on the way his troops encountered settlers moving inland, who told them the Indian wars were about over. The troops and the settlers were friendly enough to become Jean Louise Finch's ancestors, and Colonel Macon pressed on to what is now Mobile to make sure his exploits were given due credit. Recorded history's version does not coincide with the truth, but these are the facts, because they were passed down by word of mouth through the years, and every Macumbian knows them.
"Get your bags, miss," the porter said.
Jean Louise followed him from the lounge car to her compartment. She took $2 from her billfold, one for routine, one for releasing her last night. The train, of course, rushed like a bat out of hell past the station and came to a stop 440 yards beyond it. The conductor appeared, grinning, and said he was sorry. He almost forgot. Jean Louise grinned back and waited impatiently for the porter to put the yellow step in place. He handed her down, and she gave him the two bills. Her father was not waiting for her. She looked up the track toward the station and saw a tall man standing on the tiny platform. He jumped down and ran to meet her. He grabbed her in a bear hug, put her from him, kissed her hard on the mouth, then kissed her gently.
"Not here, Hank,"
she murmured, much pleased.
"Hush, girl," he said, holding her face in place. "I'll kiss you on the courthouse steps if I want to."
The possessor of the right to kiss her on the courthouse steps was Henry Clinton, her lifelong friend, her brother's comrade, and if he kept on kissing her like that, her husband. Love whom you will, but marry your own kind, was a dictum amounting to instinct within her. Henry Clinton was Jean Louise's own kind, and now she did not consider the dictum particularly harsh. They walked arm in arm down the track to collect her suitcase. "How's Atticus?" she said. "His hands and shoulders are giving him fits today. He can't drive when they're like that, can he?" Henry closed the fingers of his right hand halfway and said,
"He can't close them any more than this.
Miss Alexandra has to tie his shoes and button his shirts when they're like that. He can't even hold a razor." Jean Louise shook her head. She was too old to rail against the inequity of it, but too young to accept her father's crippling disease without putting up some kind of fight.
"Isn't there anything they can do?"
"You know there isn't," Henry said. "He takes 70 grains of aspirin a day, and that's all." Henry picked up her heavy suitcase, and they walked back toward the car. She wondered how she would behave when her time came to hurt, day in and day out. Hardly like Atticus. If you asked him how he was feeling, he would tell you. But he never complained. His disposition remained the same, so in order to find out how he was feeling, you had to ask him. The only way Henry found out about it was by accident. One day when they were in the records vault at the courthouse running a land title, Atticus hauled out a heavy mortgage book, turned stark white, and dropped it. "What's the matter?" Henry had said. "Rheumatoid arthritis. Can you pick it up for me?" said Atticus. Henry asked him how long he had had it. Atticus said 6 months. Did Jean Louise know it? No. Then he'd better tell her. "If you tell her, she'll be down here trying to nurse me. The only remedy for this is not to let it beat you." The subject was closed. "Wanna drive?" said Henry.
"Don't be silly," she said.
Although she was a respectable driver, she hated to operate anything mechanical more complicated than a safety pin. Folding lawn chairs were a source of profound irritation to her. She had never learned to ride a bicycle or use a typewriter. She fished with a pole. Her favorite game was golf, because its essential principles consisted of a stick, a small ball, and a state of mind. With green envy, she watched Henry's effortless mastery of the automobile. Cars are his servants, she thought. "Power steering? Automatic transmission?" she said.
"You bet," he said.
"Well, what if everything shuts off and you don't have any gears to shift? You'd be in trouble then, wouldn't you?"
"But everything won't shut off. How do you know?"
"That's what faith is. Come here."
Faith in General Motors. She put her head on his shoulder. "Hank," she said presently, "what really happened?"
This was an old joke between them. A pink scar started under his right eye, hit the corner of his nose, and ran diagonally across his upper lip. Behind his lip were 6 false front teeth. Not even Jean Louise could induce him to take out and show her.
He came home from the war with them. A German, more to express his displeasure at the end of the war than anything else, had bashed him in the face with a rifle butt. Jean Louise had chosen to think this a likely story. What with guns that shot over the horizon, B-17s, V-bombs, and the like, Henry had probably not been within spitting distance of the Germans.
"Okay, honey," he said. "We were down in a cellar in Berlin. Everybody had too much to drink, and a fight started. You like to hear the believable, don't you? Now will you marry me?"
"Not yet."
"Why?"
"I want to be like Dr. Schweitzer and play until I'm 30.
"He played all right," said Henry grimly.
Jean Louise moved under his arm.
"You know what I mean," she said.
"Yes."
There was no finer young man, said the people of Macomb, than Henry Clinton. Jean Louise agreed. Henry was from the southern end of the county. His father had left his mother soon after Henry was born, and she worked night and day in her little crossroads store to send Henry through the Macomb public schools. Henry, from the time he was 12, boarded across the street from the Finch House, and this in itself put him on a higher plane. He was his own master, free from the authority of cooks, yardmen, and parents. He was also 4 years her senior, which made a difference then. He teased her. She adored him. When he was 14, his mother died, leaving him next to nothing. Atticus Finch looked after what little money there was from the sale of the store. Her funeral expenses took most of it. He secretly supplemented it with money of his own and got Henry a job clerking in the Jitney Jungle after school. Henry graduated and went into the army, and after the war he went to the university and studied law. Just about that time, Jean Louise's brother dropped dead in his tracks one day, and after the nightmare of that was over, Atticus, who had always thought of leaving his practice to his son, looked around for another young man. It was natural for him to engage Henry, and in due course Henry became Atticus's leg man, his eyes, and his hands. Henry had always respected Atticus Finch. Soon it melded to affection, and Henry regarded him as a father. He did not regard Jean Louise as a sister. In the years when he was away at the war and the university, she had turned from an overawed, fractious, gun-slinging creature into a reasonable facsimile of a human being. He began dating her on her annual 2-week visits home, and although she still moved like a 13-year-old boy an abjured most feminine adornment. He found something so intensely feminine about her that he fell in love. She was easy to look at, and easy to be with, most of the time. But she was in no sense of the word an easy person. She was afflicted with a restlessness of spirit he could not guess at, but he knew she was the one for him. He would protect her. He would marry her. "Tired of New York?" he said. "No. Give me a free hand for these 2 weeks, and I'll make you tired of it." "Is that an improper suggestion?"
"Yes."
"Go to hell, then." Henry stopped the car. He turned off the ignition switch, slewed around, and looked at her. She knew when he became serious about something. His crew cut bristled like an angry brush, his face colored, its scar reddened. "Honey, do you want me to put it like a gentleman? Miss Jean Louise, I have now reached an economic status that can provide for the support of two. I, like Israel of old, have labored 7 years in the vineyards of the university and the pastures of your daddy's office for you. I'll tell Atticus to make it 7 more." "Hateful." "Besides," she said, "it was Jacob anyway." "No, they were the same. They always changed their names every 3rd verse. How's Auntie?" "You know good and well she's been fine for 30 years. Don't change the subject." Jean Louise's eyebrows flickered. "Henry," she said primly, "I'll have an affair with you, but I won't marry you." It was exactly right. "Don't be such a damn child, Jean Louise," Henry sputtered, and forgetting the latest dispensations from General Motors, grabbed for a gear shift and stomped at a clutch. These denied him. He wrenched the ignition key violently, pressed some buttons, and the big car glided slowly and smoothly down the highway. "Slow pickup, isn't it?" she said. "No good for city driving." Henry glared at her. "What do you mean by that?" In another minute, this would become a quarrel. He was serious. She'd better make him furious, thus silent, so she could think about it. "Where'd you get that appalling tie?" she said. Now, she was almost in love with him. "No, that's impossible," she thought. "Either you are or you aren't. Love's the only thing in this world that is unequivocal. There are different kinds of love, certainly, but it's a you do or you don't proposition with them all." She was a person who, when confronted with an easy way out, always took the hard way. The easy way out of this would be to marry Hank and let him labor for her. After a few years, when the children were waist high, the man would come along whom she should have married in the first place. There would be searchings of hearts, fevers and frets, long looks at each other on the post office steps, and misery for everybody. The hollering and the high-mindedness over, all that would be left would be another shabby little affair, a la the Birmingham Country Club set, and a self-constructed private Gehenna with the latest Westinghouse appliances. Hank didn't deserve that. No, for the present, she would pursue the stony path of spinsterhood. She set about restoring peace with honor. "Honey, I'm sorry, truly sorry," she said, and she was. "That's okay," said Henry, and slapped her knee. "It's just that I could kill you sometimes." "I know, I'm hateful." Henry looked at her. "You're an odd one, sweet. You can't dissemble." She looked at him. "What are you talking about?" "Well, as a general rule, most women, before they've got 'em, present to their men smiling, agreeing faces. They hide their thoughts. You know, when you're feeling hateful, honey, you are hateful. Isn't it fairer for a man to be able to see what he's letting himself in for?" "Yes, but don't you see you'll never catch a man that way?" She bit her tongue on the obvious and said, "How do I go about being an enchantress?" Henry warmed to his subject. At 30, he was an advisor, maybe because he was a lawyer. "First," he said dispassionately, "hold your tongue. Don't argue with a man, especially when you know you can beat him. Smile a lot. Make him feel big. Tell him how wonderful he is, and wait on him." She smiled brilliantly and said, "Hank, I agree with everything you've said. You are the most perspicacious individual I've met in years. You are 6'5", and may I light your cigarette?
How's that? Awful.
They were friends again. 2. Atticus Finch shot his left cuff, then cautiously pushed it back. 1:40. On some days he wore two watches. He wore two this day. An ancient watch and chain his children had cut their teeth on, and a wristwatch. The former was habit. The latter was used to tell time when he could not move his fingers enough to dig in his watch pocket. He had been a big man before age and arthritis reduced him to medium size. He was 72 last month, but Jean Louise always thought of him as hovering somewhere in his middle 50s. She could not remember him being any younger, and he seemed to grow no older. In front of the chair in which he was sitting was a steel music stand, and on the stand was the strange case of Alger Hiss. Atticus leaned forward a little, the better to disapprove of what he was reading. A stranger would not have seen annoyance on Atticus's face, for he seldom expressed it. A friend, however, would expect a dry "hmm" to come soon. Atticus's eyebrows were elevated. His mouth was a pleasant thin line. "Hmm," he said.
"What, dear?" said his sister.
"I don't understand how a man like this can have the brass to give us his views on the Hiss case. It's like Fenimore Cooper writing the Waverly novels."
"Why, dear?"
"He has a childlike faith in the integrity of civil servants, and he seems to think Congress corresponds to their aristocracy. No understanding of American politics at all."
His sister peered at the book's dust jacket.
"I'm not familiar with the author," she said, thus condemning the book forever. "Well, don't worry, dear. Shouldn't they be here now?"
"I'm not worrying, Xandra." Atticus glanced at his sister, amused. She was an impossible woman, but a sight better than having Jean Louise permanently home and miserable. When his daughter was miserable, she prowled, and Atticus liked his women to be relaxed, not constantly emptying ashtrays. He heard a car turn into the driveway. He heard two of its doors slam, then the front door slam. He carefully nudged the music stand away from him with his feet, made one futile attempt to rise from the deep armchair without using his hands, succeeded the second time, and had just balanced himself when Jean Louise was upon him. He suffered her embrace and returned it as best he could.
"Atticus," she said.
"Put her suitcase in the bedroom, please, Hank," said Atticus over her shoulder. "Thanks for meeting her."
Jean Louise pecked at her aunt and missed, took a package of cigarettes from her bag, and hurled it at the sofa.
"How's the rheumatism, Auntie?"
"Some better, sweet."
"Atticus?"
"Some better, sweet. Did you have a good trip down?"
"Yes, sir." She collapsed on the sofa. Hank returned from his chores and said, "Move over," and sat down beside her. Jean Louise yawned and stretched.
"What's the news?" she asked.
"All I get these days is reading between the lines in the Macomb Tribune. You all never write me anything."
Alexandra said, "You saw of the death of Cousin Edgar's boy. That was a mighty sad thing."
Jean Louise saw Henry and her father exchange glances. Atticus said,
"He came in late one afternoon, hot from football practice, and raided the Kappa Alpha icebox. He also ate a dozen bananas and washed them down with a pint of whiskey. An hour later, he was dead. It wasn't sad at all."
Jean Louise said, "Phew."
Alexandra said, "Atticus, you know he was Edgar's baby boy."
Henry said, "It was awful, Miss Alexandra."
"Cousin Edgar's still courting you, Auntie?" asked Jean Louise.
"Looks like after 11 years he'd ask you to marry him."
Atticus raised his eyebrows in warning.
He watched his daughter's demon rise and dominate her. Her eyebrows, like his, were lifted. The heavy-lidded eyes beneath them grew round, and one corner of her mouth was raised dangerously. When she looked thus, only God and Robert Browning knew what she was likely to say.
Her aunt protested, "Really, Jean Louise, Edgar is your father's and my first cousin."
"At this stage of the game, it shouldn't make much difference, Auntie."
Atticus asked quickly,
How did you leave the big city?
Right now, I want to know about this big city. You two never write me any dirt.
Auntie, I'm depending on you to give me a year's news in 15 minutes.
She patted Henry on the arm, more to keep him from starting a business conversation with Atticus than anything else.
Henry interpreted it as a warm gesture and returned it.
Well, said Alexandra, well, you must have heard about the Merriweathers. That was a mighty sad thing.
What happened?
They've parted.
What? Said Jean Louise in genuine amazement. You mean separated?
Yes, her aunt nodded.
She turned to her father. The Merriweathers? How long have they been married?
Atticus looked at the ceiling, remembering. He was a precise man. 42 years, he said.
I was at their wedding.
Alexandra said, we first got wind of something wrong when they'd come to church and sit on opposite sides of the auditorium.
Henry said, they glared at each other for Sundays on end.
Atticus said, and the next thing you know, they were in the office asking me to get him a divorce.
Did you? Jean Louise looked at her father.
I did.
On what grounds?
Adultery.
Jean Louise shook her head in wonder. Lord, she thought, there must be something in the water.
Alexandra's voice cut through her ruminations.
Jean Louise, did you come down on the train like that?
Caught offside, it took a moment for her to ascertain what her aunt meant by like that.
Oh, yes'm, she said. But wait a minute, Auntie.
I left New York stockinged, gloved, and shod. I put on these right after we passed Atlanta.
Her aunt sniffed.
I do wish this time you'd try to dress better while you're home. Folks in town get the wrong impression of you. They think you are, slumming.
Jean Louise had a sinking feeling. The Hundred Years' War had progressed to approximately its 26th year, with no indications of anything more than periods of uneasy truce.
Auntie, she said, I've come home for 2 weeks of just sitting, pure and simple. I doubt if I'll ever move from the house the whole time. I beat my brains out all year round.
She stood up and went to the fireplace, glared at the mantelpiece, and turned around.
If the folks in Macomb don't get one impression, they'll get another. They're certainly not used to seeing me dressed up.
Her voice became patient. Look, if I suddenly sprang on them fully clothed, they'd say I'd gone New York. Now you come along and say they think I don't care what they think when I go around in slacks. Good Lord, Auntie, Macomb knows I didn't wear anything but overalls till I started having the curse.
Atticus forgot his hands. He bent over to tie perfectly tied shoelaces and came up with a flushed but straight face.
That'll do, Scout, he said. Apologize to your aunt. Don't start a row the minute you get home.
Jean Louise smiled at her father. When registering disapprobation, he always reverted back to her childhood nickname.
She sighed. I'm sorry, Auntie. I'm sorry, Hank. I am oppressed, Atticus.
Then go back to New York and be uninhibited.
Alexandra stood up and smoothed the various whalebone ridges running up and down her person.
Did you have any dinner on the train?
Yes'm, she lied.
Then how about coffee?
Please.
Hank?
Yes'm, please.
Alexandra left the room without consulting her brother.
Jean Louise said, still haven't learned to drink it?
No, said her father.
Whiskey either?
No.
Cigarettes and women?
No.
You have any fun these days?
I manage.
Jean Louise made a golf grip with her hands.
How is it? She asked.
None of your business.
Can you still use a putter?
Yes.
You used to do pretty well for a blind man,
Atticus said. There's nothing wrong with my...
Nothing except you just can't see.
Would you care to prove that statement?
Yes, sir. Tomorrow at 3, okay?
Yes. No. I've got a meeting on.
How about Monday?
Hank, do we have anything on for Monday afternoon?
Hank stirred. Nothing but that mortgage coming up at 1. Shouldn't take more than an hour.
Atticus said to his daughter,
I'm your man, then. From the looks of you, Miss Priss, it'll be the blind leading the blind.
At the fireplace, Jean Louise had picked up a blackened old wooden shaft putter, which had done years of double duty as a poker. She emptied a great antique spittoon of its contents, golf balls, turned it on its side, kicked the golf balls into the middle of the living room, and was putting them back into the spittoon when her aunt reappeared carrying a tray of coffee, cups and saucers, and cake. "Between you and your father and your brother," Alexandra said, "that rug is a disgrace. Hank, when I came to keep house for him, the first thing I did was have it dye as dark as I could. You remember how it used to look? Why, there was a black path from here to the fireplace nothing could take out."
Hank said, "I remember it, ma'am. I'm afraid I was a contributor to it."
Jean Louise drove the putter home beside the fire tongs, gathered up the golf balls, and threw them at the spittoon. She sat on the sofa and watched Hank retrieve the strays. "I never tire of watching him move," she thought. He returned, drank a cup of scalding black coffee at an alarming rate of speed, and said, "Mr. Finch, I'd better be going."
"Wait a bit, and I'll come with you," said Atticus.
"Feel like it, sir?"
"Certainly."
"Jean Louise," he said suddenly, "how much of what's going on down here gets into the newspapers?"
"You mean politics?"
"Well, every time the governor's indiscreet, it hits the tabloids, but beyond that, nothing."
"I mean about the Supreme Court's bid for immortality."
"Oh, that. Well, to hear the Post tell it, we lynch 'em for breakfast. The Journal doesn't care, and the Times is so wrapped up in its duty to posterity it bores you to death. I haven't paid any attention to it except for the bus strikes and that Mississippi business."
"Atticus, the state's not getting a conviction in that case was our worst blunder since Pickett's charge."
"Yes, it was. I suppose the papers made hay with it. They went insane.
And the NAACP?
I don't know anything about that bunch, except that some misguided clerk sent me some NAACP Christmas seals last year, so I stuck them on all the cards I sent home. Did Cousin Edgar get his?"
"He did, and he made a few suggestions as to what I should do with you." Her father was smiling broadly.
"Like what?"
"That I should go to New York, grab you by the hair of the head, and take a switch to you. Edgar's always disapproved of you. Says you're much too independent. Never did have a sense of humor, pompous old catfish. That's just what he is. Whiskers here and here and a catfish mouth. I reckon he thinks my living alone in New York is ipso facto living in sin."
"It amounts to that," said Atticus. He hauled himself out of the armchair and motioned for Henry to get going. Henry turned to Jean Louise. 7:30, honey?" She nodded, then looked at her aunt out of the corner of her eye. "All right if I wear my slacks?"
"No, ma'am."
"Good for you, Hank," said Alexandra. 3. There was no doubt about it. Alexandra Finch Hancock was imposing from any angle. Her behind was no less uncompromising than her front. Jean Louise had often wondered but never asked where she got her corsets. They drew up her bosom to giddy heights, pinched in her waist, flared out her rear, and managed to suggest that Alexandra's had once been an hourglass figure. Of all her relatives, her father's sister came closest to setting Jean Louise's teeth permanently on edge. Alexandra had never been actively unkind to her. She had never been unkind to any living creature, except to the rabbits that ate her azaleas, which she poisoned. But she had made Jean Louise's life hell on wheels in her day, in her own time, and in her own way. Now that Jean Louise was grown, they had never been able to sustain 15 minutes conversation with one another without advancing irreconcilable points of view. Invigorating in friendships, but in close-blood relations producing only uneasy cordiality. There were so many things about her aunt Jean Louise secretly delighted in when half a continent separated them, which on contact were abrasive and were canceled out when Jean Louise undertook to examine her aunt's motives. Alexandra was one of those people who had gone through life at no cost to themselves. Had she been obliged to pay any emotional bills during her earthly life, Jean Louise could imagine her stopping at the check-in desk in heaven and demanding a refund. Alexandra had been married for 33 years. If it had made any impression on her one way or another, she never showed it. She had spawned one son, Francis, who in Jean Louise's opinion looked and behaved like a horse, and who long ago left Macomb for the glories of selling insurance in Birmingham. It was just as well. Alexandra had been, and was still technically married to a large, placid man named James Hancock, who ran a cotton warehouse with great exactitude for 6 days a week, and fished on the seventh.
One Sunday 15 years ago, he sent word to his wife by way of a Negro boy from his fishing camp on the Tensas River that he was staying down there and not coming back. After Alexandra made sure no other female was involved, she could not have cared less. Francis chose to make it his cross to bear in life. He never understood why his uncle Atticus remained on excellent but remote terms with his father. Francis thought Atticus should do something, or why his mother was not prostrate from his father's eccentric, therefore unforgivable behavior. Uncle Jimmy got wind of Francis's attitude and sent up another message from the woods that he was ready and willing to meet him if Francis wanted to come shoot him. But Francis never did. And eventually, a third communication reached Francis, to wit, "If you won't come down here like a man, hush." Uncle Jimmy's defection caused not a ripple on Alexandra's bland horizon. Her missionary society refreshments were still the best in town. Her activities in Macomb's three cultural clubs increased. She improved her collection of milk glass when Atticus pried Uncle Jimmy's money loose from him. In short, she despised men and thrived out of their presence. That her son had developed all the latent characteristics of a $3 bill escaped her notice. All she knew was that she was glad he lived in Birmingham because he was oppressively devoted to her, which meant that she felt obliged to make an effort to reciprocate, which she could not with any spontaneity do. To all parties present and participating in the life of the county, however, Alexandra was the last of her kind. She had riverboat boarding school manners. Let any moral come along and she would uphold it. She was a disapprover. She was an incurable gossip. When Alexandra went to finishing school, self-doubt could not be found in any textbook, so she knew not its meaning. She was never bored, and given the slightest chance, she would exercise her royal prerogative. She would arrange, advise, caution, and warn. She was completely unaware that with one twist of the tongue, she could plunge Jean Louise into a moral turmoil by making her niece doubt her own motives and best intentions, by tweaking the Protestant Philistine strings of Jean Louise's conscience until they vibrated like a spectral zither. Had Alexandra ever pressed Jean Louise's vulnerable points with awareness, she could have added another scalp to her belt. But after years of tactical study, Jean Louise knew her enemy. Although she could rout her, Jean Louise had not yet learned how to repair the enemy's damage. The last time she skirmished with Alexandra was when her brother died. After Jim's funeral, they were in the kitchen cleaning up the remains of the tribal banquets that are a part of dying in Macomb. Calpurnia, the Finch's old cook, had run off the place and not come back when she learned of Jim's death. Alexandra attacked like Hannibal. "I do think, Jean Louise, that now is the time for you to come home for good. Your father needs you so." From long experience, Jean Louise bristled immediately. "You lie," she thought. "If Atticus needed me, I would know it. I can't make you understand how I'd know it because I can't get through to you." "Need me?" she said. "Yes, dear. Surely you understand that. I shouldn't have to tell you." "Tell me. Settle me. There you go, wading in your clodhoppers through our private territory. Why, he and I don't even talk about it." "Auntie, if Atticus needs me, you know I'll stay. Right now he needs me like a hole in the head. We'd be miserable here in the house together. He knows it. I know it. Don't you see that unless we go back to what we were doing before this happened, our recovery will be far slower? Auntie, I can't make you understand. But truly, the only way I can do my duty to Atticus is by doing what I'm doing. Making my own living and my own life. The only time Atticus will need me is when his health fails. And I don't have to tell you what I'd do then. Don't you see?" No, she didn't. Alexandra saw what Macomb saw. Macomb expected every daughter to do her duty. The duty of his only daughter to her widowed father after the death of his only son was clear. Jean Louise would return and make her home with Atticus. That was what a daughter did, and she who did not was no daughter. "You can get a job at the bank and go to the coast on weekends. There's a cute crowd in Macomb now, lots of new young people. You like to paint, don't you?" Like to paint? What the hell did Alexandra think she was doing with her evenings in New York? The same as Cousin Edgar, probably. Art Students League every weeknight at 8. Young ladies sketched, did watercolors, wrote short paragraphs of imaginative prose. To Alexandra, there was a distinct and distasteful difference between one who paints and a painter, one who writes and a writer. There are a lot of pretty views on the coast, and you'll have weekends free.
Jehovah.
She catches me when I'm nearly out of my mind and lays out the avenues of my life. How can she be his sister and not have the slightest idea what goes on in his head? My head? Anybody's head? Oh, Lord, why didn't you give us tongues to explain to Aunt Alexandra?
Auntie,
it's easy to tell somebody what to do, but very hard to make them do it. That's the cause of most trouble in this world. People not doing as they're told. It was decided upon, definitely. Jean Louise would stay home. Alexandra would tell Atticus, and it would make him the happiest man in the world. Auntie, I'm not staying home, and if I did, Atticus would be the saddest man in the world. But don't worry. Atticus understands perfectly, and I'm sure once you get started, you'll make him understand. The knife hit deep, suddenly.
Jean Louise, your brother worried about your thoughtlessness until the day he died.
It was raining softly on his grave now, in the hot evening. You never said it. You never even thought it. If you'd have thought it, you'd have said it. You were like that. Rest well, Jim. She rubbed salt into it. I'm thoughtless, all right. Selfish, self-willed. I eat too much, and I feel like the Book of Common Prayer. Lord, forgive me for not doing what I should have done. And for doing what I shouldn't have done. Oh, hell. She returned to New York. With a throbbing conscience. Not even Atticus could ease. This was 2 years ago, and Jean Louise had long since quit worrying about how thoughtless she was, and Alexandra had disarmed her by performing the one generous act of Alexandra's life. When Atticus developed arthritis, Alexandra went to live with him. Jean Louise was humble with gratitude. Had Atticus known of the secret decision between his sister and his daughter, he would have never forgiven them. He did not need anyone, but it was an excellent idea to have someone around to keep an eye on him, button his shirts when his hands were useless, and run his house. Calpurnia had done it until 6 months ago, but she was so old Atticus did more housekeeping than she, and she returned to the quarters in honorable retirement. I'll do those, Auntie, Jean Louise said when Alexandra collected the coffee cups. She rose and stretched. You get sleepy when it's like this. Just these few cups, said Alexandra. I can do them in a minute. You stay where you are. Jean Louise stayed where she was and looked around the living room. The old furniture set well in the new house. She glanced toward the dining room and saw on the sideboard her mother's heavy silver water pitcher, goblets, and tray, shining against the soft green wall. He is an incredible man, she thought. A chapter of his life comes to a close. Atticus tears down the old house and builds a new one in a new section of town. I couldn't do it. They built an ice cream parlor where the old one was. Wonder who runs it. She went to the kitchen. Well, how's New York? Said Alexandra. Want another cup before I throw this out? Yes'm, please. Oh, by the way, I'm giving a coffee for you Monday morning.
Auntie, Jean Louise groaned. Coffees were peculiarly Macombian in nature. They were given for girls who came home. Such girls were placed on view at 10:30 a.m. for the express purpose of allowing the women of their age who had remained annulled in Macomb to examine them. Childhood friendships were rarely renewed under such conditions. Jean Louise had lost touch with nearly everyone she grew up with and did not wish particularly to rediscover the companions of her adolescence. Her school days were her most miserable days. She was unsentimental to the point of callousness about the women's college she had attended. Nothing displeased her more than to be set in the middle of a group of people who played Remember Old So-and-So? I find the prospect of a coffee infinitely horrifying, she said.
But I'd love one.
I thought you would, dear.
A pang of tenderness swept over her. She would never be able to thank Alexandra enough for coming to stay with Atticus. She considered herself a heel for ever having been sarcastic to her aunt, who in spite of her corsets had a certain defenselessness, plus a certain fineness Jean Louise would never have. She is the last of her kind, she thought,
No wars had ever touched her, and she had lived through three. Nothing had disturbed that world of hers, where gentlemen smoked on the porch or in hammocks, where ladies fanned themselves gently and drank cool water.
How's Hank doing?
He's doing beautifully, hon. You know he was made man of the year by the Kiwanis Club. They gave him a lovely scroll.
No, I didn't.
Man of the year by the Kiwanis Club, a post-war make-em innovation, usually meant young man going places.
Atticus was so proud of him. Atticus says he doesn't know the meaning of the word contract yet, but he's doing fine with taxation.
Jean Louise grinned. Her father said it took at least 5 years to learn law after one left law school. One practiced economy for 2 years, learned Alabama pleading for 2 more, reread the Bible and Shakespeare for 5th. Then one was fully equipped to hold on under any conditions.
What would you say if Hank became your nephew?
Alexandra stopped drying her hands on the dish towel. She turned and looked sharply at Jean Louise.
Are you serious?
I might be.
Don't be in a hurry, honey.
Hurry? I'm 26, Auntie, and I've known Hank forever.
Yes, but what's the matter? Don't you approve of him?
It's not that. It's...
Jean Louise, dating a boy is one thing, but marrying him's another. You must take all things into account. Henry's background is literally the same as mine. We grew up in each other's pockets. There's a drinking streak in that family.
Auntie, there's a drinking streak in every family.
Alexandra's back stiffened. Not in the Finch family.
You're right. We're just all crazy.
That's untrue, and you know it, said Alexandra. Cousin Joshua was round the bend. Don't forget that. You know he got it from the other side. Jean Louise, there's no finer boy in this county than Henry Clinton. He would make some girl a lovely husband. But you're saying that a Clinton's not good enough for a Finch, Auntie Honey. That sort of thing went out with the French Revolution, or began with it, I forget which. I'm not saying that at all. It's just that you should be careful about things like this.
Jean Louise was smiling, and her defenses were checked and ready. It was beginning again.
Lord, why did I ever even hint at it? She could have kicked herself.
Aunt Alexandra, if given the chance, would pick out some nice clean cow of a girl from Wild Fork for Henry and give the children her blessing. That was Henry's place in life.
Well, I don't know how careful you can get, Auntie. Atticus would love having Hank officially with us. You know it'd tickle him to death.
Indeed it would. Atticus Finch had watched Henry's ragged pursuit of his daughter with benign objectivity, giving advice when asked for it, but absolutely declining to become involved.
Atticus is a man. He doesn't know much about these things.
Jean Louise's teeth began to hurt.
What things, Auntie? Now look, Jean Louise, if you had a daughter, what would you want for her? Nothing but the best, naturally. You don't seem to realize it, and most people your age don't seem to. How would you like to know your daughter was going to marry a man whose father deserted him and his mother and died drunk on the railroad tracks in Mobile? Kara Clinton was a good soul, and she had a sad life, and it was a sad thing. But you think about marrying the product of such a union?
It's a solemn thought. A solemn thought, indeed. Jean Louise saw the glint of gold-rimmed spectacles slung across a sour face, looking out from under a crooked wig. The twitter of a bony finger, she said.
The question, gentlemen, is one of liquor. You ask for guidance. This is my reply. He says, when tipsy, he would thrash and kick her. Let's make him tipsy, gentlemen, and try.
Alexandra was not amused. She was extremely annoyed. She could not comprehend the attitudes of young people these days. Not that they needed understanding. Young people were the same in every generation. But this cockiness, this refusal to take seriously the gravest questions of their lives, nettled and irritated her. Jean Louise was about to make the worst mistake of her life, and she glibly quoted those people at her. She mocked her. That girl should have had a mother. Atticus had let her run wild since she was 2 years old, and look what he had reaped. Now she needed bringing up to the line and bringing up sharply before it was too late.
Jean Louise, she said, I would like to remind you of a few facts of life.
No,
Alexandra held out her hand for silence. I am quite sure you know those facts already, but there are a few things you, in your wisecracking way, don't know. And bless goodness, I'm going to tell you. You are as innocent as a new-laid egg for all your city living. Henry is not, and never will be suitable for you. We Finches do not marry the children of red-necked white trash, which is exactly what Henry's parents were when they were born, and were all their lives. You can't call them anything better. The only reason Henry's like he is now is because your father took him in hand when he was a boy, and because the war came along and paid for his education. Fine a boy as he is, the trash won't wash out of him. Have you ever noticed how he licks his fingers when he eats cake? Trash. Have you ever seen him cough without covering his mouth? Trash. Did you know he got a girl in trouble at the university? Trash. Have you ever watched him pick at his nose when he didn't think anybody was looking? Trash. That's not the trash in him. That's the man in him, Auntie, she said mildly. Inwardly, she was seething. Give her a few more minutes and she'll have worked herself into a good humor again. She can never be vulgar, as I'm about to be. She can never be common, like Hank and me. I don't know what she is, but she better lay off or I'll give her something to think about. And to top it all, he thinks he can make a place for himself in this town, riding on your father's coattails. The very idea, trying to take your father's place in the Methodist Church. Trying to take over his law practice, driving all around the country in his car. Why, he acts like this house was his own already, and what does Atticus do? He takes it. That's what he does. Takes it and loves it. Why, all of Macomb's talking about Henry Clinton grabbing everything Atticus has. Jean Louise stopped running her fingers around the lip of a wet cup on the sink. She flicked a drop of water off her finger onto the floor and rubbed it into the linoleum with her shoe. Auntie, she said cordially, why don't you go pee in your hat? The ritual enacted on Saturday nights between Jean Louise and her father was too old to be broken. Jean Louise walked into the living room and stood in front of his chair. She cleared her throat. Atticus put down the mobile press and looked at her. She turned around slowly. Am I all zipped up? Stockings seem straight? Is my cowlick down?
7 o'clock, and all's well, said Atticus. You've been swearing at your aunt.
I have not.
She told me you had.
I was crude, but I didn't cuss her. When Jean Louise and her brother were children, Atticus had occasionally drawn them a sharp distinction between mere scatology and blasphemy. The one he could abide. He hated dragging God into it. As a result, Jean Louise and her brother never swore in his presence. She got my goat, Atticus.
You shouldn't have let her.
What did you say to her?
Jean Louise told him. Atticus winced.
Well, you better make peace with her.
Sweet, she gets on a high horse sometimes, but she's a good woman.
It was about Hank, and she made me mad.
Atticus was a wise man, so he dropped the subject.
The Finch doorbell was a mystical instrument. It was possible to tell the state of mind of whoever pushed it. When it said, da-ding, Jean Louise knew Henry was outside bearing down happily. She hurried to the door. The pleasant, remotely masculine smell of him hit her when he walked into the hall, but shaving cream, tobacco, new car, and dusty books faded at the memory of the conversation in the kitchen. Suddenly, she put her arms around his waist and nuzzled her head on his chest.
What was that for? Said Henry delightedly.
General principals who fought in the Peninsula War. Let's get going. Henry peered around the corner at Atticus in the living room. I'll bring her home early, Mr. Finch. Atticus jiggled the paper at him. When they walked out into the night, Jean Louise wondered what Alexandra would do if she knew her niece was closer to marrying trash than she had ever been in her life.
Part 2. 4. The town of Macomb, Alabama, owed its location to the presence of mind of one Sinkfield, who in the early dawnings of the county operated an inn where two pig trails met, the only tavern in the territory. Governor William Wyatt Bibb, with a view to promoting the domestic tranquility of the new county, sent out a